It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Negotiations continue between the county and East Pittsburgh and North Braddock over police operations in those municipalities. Allegheny County Executive Rich Fitzgerald has historically been a big proponent of shared services. Mr. Fitzgerald, what can the county do to help struggling communities, in this case these particular two communities, to make sure that they're safe through quality policing?
Yeah, one of the things that's very difficult with 130 different municipalities are the cost structure of how we do this. And we would love to be able to partner in a fiscally sound way. The issue really comes down to cost. And in some of these municipalities, their budget for policing might be, and I'm just going to use numbers, maybe a couple of $100,000, where really the county cost, if we went in and do it, might be $700,000 or $800,000, three or four times the level. So it's one of those things we're working on. You know, the cost of some of the policing in these areas is you know, they're paying them $10, $12, $15 an hour, where the average cost for a county police officer is about $100,000 a year. So trying to balance those out is very difficult. In some other jurisdictions outside of the county, the state police actually provide some of the services where municipal police doesn't have the function to do that. So some of the bills that we've talked about, the voluntary disincorporation and other things, might be a way to move along those lines.
So East Pittsburgh and North Braddock officials, they've been thinking about this idea about disbanding police departments for a while, and it seemed to garner greater attention after the shooting death of Antoine Rose by an East Pittsburgh police officer. So you mentioned the cost. The county police, their duties right now are really different. They're not really patrollers. They're investigators in helping the suburban police departments investigate crimes.
Well, that's exactly right. Our county police typically, as you said, are investigators. They go in and do homicide investigations and other type of investigations. And oftentimes they work on task forces, whether it be drug task forces or other type of task forces, sometimes undercover. So They typically, you're right, historically have had a little bit of a different function. But I think in some of our communities that have seen really a loss of population, and I'm talking a significant loss of population and a loss of value in their real estate valuation, which is basically the basis of how they get revenues, it's made it very difficult. They still have the same amount of roads they have to pave. They still have the same amount of miles they have to patrol on streets, those type of things, but they don't have the tax base that's paying for it that they had historically. So I do think whether it's with the county or even if some of these municipalities can work together and consolidate among themselves, and we've seen some of that. Ohio Township, for example, there's a number of municipalities out in the western suburbs along the Allegheny River Boulevard corridor, the Ohio River corridor, that have done that. Up in the North Hills, they've the northern regional police officers that have come together. We haven't seen that as much in some of the eastern and Mon Valley communities, and I think it is time to probably have that conversation.
What if they sort of banded together, got a handful of adjacent municipalities, and then approached the county? Might that make it more cost-effective?
It might, and that's something, again, we'd have to take a look at, because you're talking about really using some efficiencies or economies of scale by using a number of municipalities that might be willing to do that.
You mentioned disincorporation earlier. They're not talking about this as far as I know. But what would happen if somebody did? I mean, who would be providing the, you know, police security? Would state police have to pick it up, or would county police step in? How would that work?
That would be the county police, but it would be broader than just police. It would be all of government services, and it would be all the revenues would also be collected by the county. So it would be a total shift. Actually, the bill is in Harrisburg and passed committee unanimously to move the voluntary disincorporation bill. So I think there is some momentum in Harrisburg to at least look at some of these things. And again, it's all voluntary, so there's lots of different options. This is just be one tool out of many. Again, there could be consolidation among municipalities right now that could exist if the two communities or three communities got together and decided that that's something that they wanted to do.
Whether it's policing or all other government services, does it come down to the fact there are 130 municipalities and there's still that desire for local control?
Well, there could be, and each individual community, you know, has to speak for themselves. Some do, some don't. I mean, it's just a different philosophy in how you think the governmental structure should be set up. Obviously, things come down to cost often because it's the taxpayers who are going to be paying the bill for the services that are provided. And, you know, if it can be done more efficiently, sometimes it's worthwhile doing. If sometimes there's a thought that there wouldn't be the kind of local control, then it wouldn't be worth doing. But I think it's something that each individual municipality is going to have to take a look at and think about on their own.
I want to switch topics on you. The board of the Allegheny County Airport Authority voted recently to prohibit its members from investing directly in airlines. That came after two board members, Robert Lewis and Jan Ray, acknowledged their investment in one jet, which the airport authority is suing. Were you surprised that such investments were not prohibited already prior to this?
Well, I think it was something that came to light. My sense is that there were a number of people in the community that really wanted to help this region by helping a startup airline and provide a lot of connections to some of the communities that we need to get to, the Albanys, the Hartford, Connecticut's, the Kansas Cities, that right now there wasn't direct service to. So by providing the ability for them to capitalize and get planes and get the equipment they need to get up and running, there were people that quite frankly, I think did this for the right reasons. But when you look at the optics of you know, being able to invest in an airline when you sit on the board, we just thought, you know, this was the best practice to go forward with.
I believe you said prior to this that you were okay with Robert Lewis, Jan Ray staying on the board as long as they didn't vote on anything from which they would benefit financially. Is that correct?
Yeah, and they hadn't. And talking to the solicitor, there were no votes or no, there was certainly no financial gain. So the policies in place that they would have to disinvest, which they're, I assume, in the process of doing, and that any other board member who would serve on into the future can't have a financial interest in an airline, because, you know, you potentially could have some sort of inside information about the airline industry sitting on a board to know what's going to happen. So again, this is a board that's really worked well. We've seen nothing but improvement at the airport over the last 3 or 4 years. The amount of flights, the vitality, and you know, getting British Airways and getting the Seattle flight when we're in the middle of the Amazon competition. All those things that this airport has done has been something. Just really, it's been a benefit to this region.
You mentioned the possibility of some insider information, even if they recused themselves from voting on anything to do with the company. So it's also having to deal with even the appearance of impropriety, having some sort of relationship with an airline and you're on the airport authority board.
Yeah, and it wouldn't just be this airline, it could be any airline. And, you know, so again, just to put a policy in place that has that comfort level and nobody can be part of an investment for an airline, you know, gives folks comfort level.
By the way, you just alluded to Amazon when we were talking about a flight to Seattle. I was talking to the mayor last week. I asked him if he had had any communication whatsoever since the visit. Any communication with you?
They've been pretty tight-lipped. You know, every once in a while they might need a clarification on some information that came out of the region. But, you know, I think they've indicated through public statements and other publications that have been out there that they want to make this decision by the end of the year. You know, there's these 20 cities that made the finals, and Pittsburgh should be, again, very, very proud that we're one of them. But we're all sitting and waiting waiting for that word to come down. So we're still optimistic. We still think we're the best city, and I'm sure there's 19 other cities that think the same thing.
I'm curious. You hear Pittsburgh was not chosen. Was the process worth it?
Absolutely. This has been a very positive process because we have seen many companies who have come to us. I think in many ways, and we started to make some short lists because we made that Amazon list. It's a thing that happens, just human nature. Oh, Pittsburgh. What's going on in Pittsburgh? We hadn't thought of them. Oh, they made the top 20 in Amazon's list. Maybe there's something in Pittsburgh we better take a look at. So you get a second look, and they say, oh, they have some great tech stuff going on there. They have great neighborhoods. They have great quality of life. Oh, what's the cost of housing? It's what? Oh, that's way better than what we were looking at in some of these other cities. So it has been a great process, and it has given us a process to continue to pull people together, pull organizations together. So it's been a very, very positive aspect. And I think about, like, the things that we consider things we need to improve on. the flight to Seattle. We didn't have a flight to Seattle last year. We knew that was an important thing. So that's just one example. So improving transportation, improving education, improving affordable housing, improving all the things we know we need to do, it's helped us along those lines as well.
Allegheny County Executive Rich Fitzgerald, thanks so much.
Thanks, Kevin. Good to be with you.
I'm Megan Harris. Coming up on The Confluence, what happens when private donors worried about the opioid crisis step up to fund a beleaguered district attorney's office? The answer isn't as straightforward as some hoped. And 50 years ago this week, moviegoers looking for a pre-Halloween scare got more than they bargained for when a low-budget horror flick filmed outside Pittsburgh hit the theaters. A look back at the legacy of filmmaker George Romero and his crowning glory, Night of the Living Dead. Plus, a peek into a new pop-up bar also honoring the undead all this month. That's coming up on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Yeah, 10-4, Big Ben for sure.
Life on the road can be lonely. Music can help. Trucker anthems have been a part of commerce since the early days of the interstates, but really began to hit their stride in the 1960s with Hank Snow's. The genre peaked in the mid-1970s with Jerry Reed's from Smokey and the Bandit, and Convoy by C.W. McCall, which was later turned into a major motion picture.
It was the dark of the moon on the 6th of June in a Kenworth pulling log.
Today is October 4th, and that's a Big Ten 4, good buddy. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Pennsylvania keeps more than 5,300 inmates behind bars for life without the possibility of parole. That's second only to Florida, and it's a result of state law, which mandates life sentences for people convicted of first or second degree murder. 90.5 WESA's Unley Herring spoke with a family member of a woman who was sentenced to spend the rest of her life in prison, barring a change to the law.
Jane Hines' niece Amanda was sentenced to life without parole, or what opponents of the practice call death by incarceration, 5 years ago. I'm joined by Jane Hine now. Jane, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Now, Jane, can you start by telling me how your niece, Amanda, ended up serving a life term in prison? What was she convicted of?
Well, Amanda gave birth to a baby in a sports bar. She thought she was about 2.5 months pregnant, and it turns out that she was full term. The baby was born in the bathroom and appeared to be stillborn. And Amanda abandoned the baby there. So Amanda thought that she had left a dead baby behind. She was confronted with the fact that the baby had been born alive and was threatened with the death penalty. She was offered a plea deal where she would plead guilty to murder, and the jury would find her either guilty of murder one, which is a mandatory life without parole sentence, or murder three. And the jury found that given the DA's definition of intent, that since she didn't come out of the bathroom saying, somebody please help my dead baby, that she did not intend for the baby to live, and they found her guilty of murder one.
When you think about the possible sentences, it sounds like capital punishment was a possibility. Do you take any comfort in the fact that Amanda is still alive, even though she is serving a life sentence?
Not really, because when somebody is sentenced to capital punishment, we don't execute people anymore. So if she had been subject to that sentence, she would be just as much alive. I wouldn't be able to have any contact with her. But the way the state prison system is set up, there's only two female prisons in this state, and neither one of them is close to a city center. Amanda is at Muncie Prison. It's 5 hours for me, so that's an overnight stay. The way I do visit her is there's a company that sets up virtual visitation. I'm allowed to visit her once a month for an hour by going to a site in Pittsburgh and video conferencing with her.
Were you close with Amanda?
Amanda grew up on the other side of the state. When she was little, her grandmother would bring her to visit me when my children were born. And My mother-in-law was a very special person, and she took care of Amanda when her parents split up, and when she died, and this happened to Amanda, I had to get involved because there was no one else left who loved her like my mother-in-law did.
Had you always felt so passionately about this issue before Amanda had her experience?
I never gave this issue a thought. Unlike most of America, the prison system is set up to take these people and hide them away from polite society. It took me a while to even talk about Amanda's case, and I still get very emotional about it, but it took a long while to overcome the stigma of having someone that you know in jail. But once I got to know what exactly happens in the state, I'm appalled. And it's also created some issues within the family. The prison system is designed to alienate the incarcerated person from the rest of society. And with Amanda, a lot of her family members have chosen to just kind of write her off, and that makes me quite angry.
Stepping back, what does it say to you, having someone who has felt fully the consequences of our sentencing policy here in Pennsylvania, what does it say to you about our criminal justice system and how we treat people convicted of serious crimes that we have this policy on the books?
I consider myself to be a Christian. This policy flies in the face of every Christian principle I believe in. Jesus could use murderers. He used Moses. He used Paul. Their murderers and serious criminals can be rehabilitated, can be redeemed, can have value. Matter of fact, these people that were sentenced to die in prison, that have been in prison for 30 or 40 years and are now 40, 50, 60 years old, they want to get out. They want to change their communities. They want to be there for their families and make sure the rest of their families don't take this path, that the other people in their communities do not take this path.
Jane Hine, thank you for coming in to talk with us and sharing your story.
Oh, you're welcome.
WESA's Anlie Herring spoke with Jane Hine, who traveled with 50 people from the Pittsburgh area to Harrisburg this week. They joined other activists to rally in support of a bill that's now stalled in the Senate that would make inmates serving life sentences eligible for parole 15 years into their term. You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. The opioid epidemic in Pennsylvania has brought with it an onslaught of problems that counties have struggled to keep up with. In Blair County, home to Altoona and Hollidaysburg, a community organization has stepped up to fill some of that void. It's raised millions in private funding to help its district attorney's office more aggressively prosecute drug crimes. But as Keystone Crossroads' Min Shin reports, this has put the county's already overburdened public defender's office at an even greater disadvantage.
At the golf course on the edge of I-99 in Altoona, a nonprofit called Operation Our Town is hosting its sixth annual golf fundraiser.
Last putt, John Heim.
About 300 golfers are in attendance and have made donations ranging between $150 and $6,000. The cause, one that Operation Our Town founder and chairman Michael Fury says is of common concern for the community, fighting drug crimes.
When I founded this organization, I put 25 names of businesses together. And I went out and asked everyone. Not one turned me down. I actually ended up with 28.
Since its inception in 2006, Operation Our Town has raised nearly $4 million, mainly from local business donations and partially from federal grants. Some money goes to after-school programs and community roundtables, prevention efforts for a county that saw 52 overdose deaths last year and has had a drug death rate higher than the state average.
It's just unfair. I mean, kids just don't have, if they make that choice, there's no turning back.
The bulk of the group's funding, though, has gone to local law enforcement, including the county's drug task force. Last year, they gave police more than $150,000 to pay for search warrants, tactical equipment, and forensic software. They also provide the county with grants that are earmarked for the DA's office, including one that covers the salary of an assistant district attorney who's specifically assigned to prosecute drug cases. For 10 years, that person was Peter Weeks. He's now the first assistant district attorney of Blair County, and says the aggressive drug prosecution supported by the operation has been direly needed.
When you burglarize your grandparents' residence, you know, and steal their wedding ring that they've had for 50 years and sell it for two bags of heroin, there's something wrong with you. And it shows you the power of drug addiction. And that, you know, that's not the kind of crime anyone should want in their community.
The extra money has made a difference. The organization points to the increase in drug arrests and prosecutions as a point of pride in its fight against the drug epidemic in the area. Keystone Crossroads found that the county has the second highest amount of criminal drug cases per capita in the Commonwealth, following Philadelphia. Again, Michael Fury.
We fund them every year and give them the tools that they need to really be successful in what they're doing.
But not everyone in the county is in favor of Operation Our Town. Julie Burke is an assistant public defender. She says the operation has put immense pressure on her already overworked colleagues and does not address the real cause of the drug problem.
People use drugs because they are trying to cope with a life that they can't cope with sober. If you put criminal sanctions on top of that, it just becomes worse.
Burke says the DA's office and the drug task force make arrests and pursue harsh charges without making the distinction between drug dealers and drug users who commit low-level crimes. So she says many people in need of treatment end up behind bars.
That's one of the other problems with the lack of resources, is they have a ton of money to go out and arrest people. We are overwhelmed with defending them. And I mean, a lot of people plead guilty that shouldn't plead guilty on those cases because they're too afraid to go to trial.
She says sometimes it feels like she's not properly serving her clients. Our analysis of 2015 data found that public defenders in Blair each juggled an average caseload of about 250 adult criminal cases, one of the highest rates in the state. Since then, things have improved, but Burke says she still feels spread too thin.
Anytime you're choosing to work on one thing, you're choosing not to work on everything else. And, you know, there's some things that are very pressing time-wise, and so you tend to do those, but then sort of the longer-term projects just kind of fall by the wayside sometimes.
This year, Blair County has 6 full-time public defenders, while the 8 attorney crew at the DA's office has a budget nearly 70% more than the PD's office. Peter Weeks in the DA's office minimizes the idea that things are tipped against the public defender office. He says the entire county government is underfunded.
I would agree that prosecutors and public defenders, especially in Blair County, are drastically underfunded, but it certainly would not be the responsibility of citizens looking to make their community safer to pay for the criminal defense of people who are involved in making their community unsafe.
Julie Burke says that sentiment speaks to a common misunderstanding of her job as a public defender.
I spend my day trying to humanize people and show the complexity of their existence and that they're not criminal charges. You know, that is not representative of who they are. We're not defending the act of rape. We're not defending child molestation. You know, we're not sanctioning the conduct. But I think every human being can be defended for their humanity, even if they did a bad thing.
Back at the golf course, Fury says the fundraiser is a success, pulling in more than $100,000. He calls it, quote, a remarkable achievement from the community. Min Shen, Keystone Crossroads.
And joining us now is Keystone Crossroads reporter Emily Previty, who spearheaded this project on the public defense system in Pennsylvania. Thanks for joining us, Emily.
Glad to be here, Kevin.
Emily, let's get to the basics. What really got you interested in this whole subject matter?
So we were surprised to learn that Pennsylvania is the only state that doesn't provide at least some state funding for its public defender system. The majority, I think about 30 states, either exclusively or mainly fund their public defense systems, and the rest kick in at least something. And all this despite the fact that 7 years ago, when there were still more states not funding or overseeing their indigent defense systems, there was a legislative report that came out that pointed to how much is unknown and pointed out that there was no real guidance for things like attorney caseloads, requirements, or qualification guidelines for people who were hoping to get the services of a public defender's office. So we took a look at that report, realized nothing had been done since then, and decided to try to take a closer look.
She also reported that data is difficult to find and maybe piecemeal at best. How did you go about collecting what you could?
It was basic budget data, but of course that's kept differently in every county. It's not really reported anywhere in one file or anything like that. I mean, the DCED, the Department of Community and Economic Development, does collect some county budget data, but it doesn't break it down by department, which is obviously what we would have needed to know to look at how the system is funded currently. And so it really was first going online, looking to see what we could get from budgets and audits and things like that that were online. And we got some information that way, but most of it was not accessible just by going to county's websites. We had to file right-to-know requests, and then those would come back, wouldn't have what we were looking for. So we'd say, okay, you know, it wasn't in your payroll record, so maybe it was in your meeting minutes or something along those lines. And we did this for both the DA and the public defender's offices, 2008 and 2015 in every county. We were looking for each department's total budget, their expenses and revenues, their staffing level, so that's full and part-time attorneys or support staff. And we were also looking for salaries. So chief public defender or the district attorney, him or herself, on down to a starting salary for an assistant district attorney or assistant public defender. Parity in salaries between assistants in those two offices is a more straightforward way to assess, in combination with other metrics, whether a county is making a good faith effort to try to provide an adequate defense for people who cannot afford an attorney within, you know, the scope of that county's resources.
Often when a reporting project such as this is initiated, it's obviously to inform the public, but also maybe shine a light. Do you expect any change in that data collection process as a result of your reporting or other efforts?
No. You live in Pennsylvania. You know how quickly the legislature moves, how responsive they are. And this is just an issue that doesn't seem to inspire any action on the part of our legislature. I think that, you know, you are seeing more bipartisan support for criminal justice reform bills about other issues like mandatory life without parole sentences. And they're getting more backing from conservatives than they did in the past. You know, typically that was more of something that was like a liberal issue. But they are getting bipartisan support to a greater degree than they have in the past. And one example of an issue that I think could have direct bearing on Pennsylvania and other states' public defense systems is bail reform. That seems to be picking up a lot of steam nationally. And if representation at a bail hearing becomes a requirement imposed externally, Pennsylvania will have no choice but to overhaul and increase funding for its public defense system, even if the data isn't there to back that up.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the bail issues in other states and addressing the affordability of bail. Are there models used by other states that Pennsylvania might consider adopting regarding the funding of a public defense system?
It really does run the gamut as far as how much oversight, how much funding other states provide, or if it's simply a state-level system. The American Bar Association has consulted on caseload studies in, I think, 4 other states at this point. Their goal is to do 12 and then do a study of those 12 collectively to come up with caseload recommendations. And I'm bringing up caseloads because that's very much tied into funding and oversight, because that's what this all comes down to, right? The public defenders perhaps not having enough resources to provide an adequate defense. So they've only done those studies in states that have a more centralized court system, not a decentralized court system like Pennsylvania has. However, when I talk to the state's former consultants who have worked in other states on criminal justice issues, on cutting costs for prisons, improving operations, they said that Pennsylvania actually does have a pretty good setup, shockingly, as far as data collection compared to other states with decentralized court systems versus, you know, statewide, state-run. Texas could be a model because they also have a decentralized court system and have relatively recently made some reforms and strides related to indigent defense. New York recently started pumping a lot of money into its indigent defense system over the past year or so. So taking a look at what those two states are doing that are comparable in relevant ways to Pennsylvania, that could perhaps generate some ideas.
So, Emily, should we be comparing these inequities, Pennsylvania versus other states, or even county to county? Maybe Allegheny or Philadelphia has more money to invest in the public defender's office than a smaller county.
State to state, it's very hard to say because there are so many differences. It's part of the reason why the ABA is doing this individualized study of caseload, because their plan is to eventually come up with recommendations that are different based on certain factors within a state's court criminal justice system. But there are definitely inequities among counties. And again, there's not a ton of information out there. I mean, we looked at data from the Administrative Office of Pennsylvania Courts for caseload information, and that provided us adult criminal caseload information. But in some counties, adult criminal matters make up pretty much the entirety of what a public defender's office would handle. In others, it's a very small portion of it, and they have mental health commitment hearings. They're doing custody hearings for matters where children and youth has gotten involved. They're handling appeals, all of these things that are not represented by the data that's available on a statewide basis. So there are inequities we can pinpoint based on the data, and then there's this whole universe of other things where we really don't have a good idea.
Emily Previty is a Keystone Crossroads reporter who spearheaded this project, No Justice for All, about the public defense system in Pennsylvania. Emily, thanks so much for joining us, and thanks for your good work.
Thank you, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. 50 years ago this week, moviegoers looking for a pre-Halloween scare got more than they bargained for when a low-budget horror flick filmed outside of Pittsburgh hit the theaters. Night of the Living Dead broke new ground and resulted in its director, George Romero, being crowned as the father of the modern horror genre. WESA's Maria Scapoletto spoke with Pitt Professor of Film Studies Adam Lowenstein about the movie's impact on cinema and culture.
People at the movie's premiere said for years they were really shocked by what they saw on screen. What made Night of the Living Dead so innovative?
It remade the horror genre as something that's closer to home to us, more about our everyday lives, rather than something foreign and fantastic. I mean, think about before Night of the Living Dead, we have things more like Dracula and the Frankenstein monster. After Night of the Living Dead, we have much more human monsters and scary things that are more likely that we'll run into in our everyday lives.
Yeah, the fact that it was shot on a low budget in the outskirts of Western Pennsylvania, mostly in Evans City, did that make it even more frightening for viewers that these could be your neighbors and your friends and your family?
Absolutely. There's a way in which Night of the Living Dead feels more like a newscast often than a horror film. And I think that's a big part of the film's power is its ability to be so real to us.
You know, people were really shocked in news accounts by the level of gore and violence in it back in 1968. It really frightened people. They really weren't expecting this, were they?
No. And the initial reviews of the film were incredibly negative. One of them called the movie an unrelieved orgy of sadism based on the violence and the gore in the film. But just 2 years later, in 1970, George Romero was asked to visit the Museum of Modern Art and talk about why the film was so socially and politically important on the occasion of the film being acquired for the Museum of Modern Art's permanent collection. And I think one way to think about that change is to think about the years between 1968 and 1970 as two of the most turbulent and violent in American history. And the movie went from seeming out of bounds to seeming very much of the times.
Zombie movies and television shows, they're really popular today. What is the fascination that the public has with the zombie genre?
Well, George used to always say, and I think he was absolutely right, that the zombie is us. Rather than a creature that's fantastic and as different from us as can be, the zombie is a very working class, everyday monster. If you encounter just one of them, you're probably likely to vanquish it because they don't have a lot of power or strength or smarts. But what they have is the numbers and a mass importance. You know, when they're together, they're very powerful. When they're alone, they're very weak. And I think there's something about the zombie condition and the human condition that are more intimate than oppositional.
Do those political class racial divisions that existed way back in 1968, do they still exist somewhat today? And can social media be fanning these flames? And what do you think Romero would say about our condition today as opposed to 1968?
Well, I feel like as a testament to both Night of the Living Dead's power and the sort of deep crisis of our current political climate, it feels like Night of the Living Dead to me is at least as timely and relevant and urgent today as it was in 1968. I mean, again, we are living in a political climate that's extremely polarized. If we think about the pro-war and anti-war, establishment counterculture sorts of divisions, pro-civil rights, segregationist divisions that we think of in 68, we can turn to contemporary examples now that are eerily similar.
Adam Lowenstein, thanks for coming in to talk about the film. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Maria Scappelletto talking to Pitt film professor Adam Lowenstein. Pittsburghers will be celebrating the 50th anniversary of Romero's classic film all this month. A complete list is available at romerolives.org. Now, a pop-up zombie den that found inspiration from Night of the Living Dead opened last night in downtown Pittsburgh. 90.5 WESA's Sabrina Bowden checked out the bar in Market Square.
Apocalypse Punch, Penicillin, and Who Let the Virus Out will be on the menu of the pop-up zombie-themed bar at the original Oyster House in Market Square. Scott Simmons is co-owner and creative director of the haunted attraction, Scare House. He says his team will temporarily transform the classic decor of the Oyster House into a George Romero-inspired haven for the uninfected.
So in the case of a zombie outbreak, there would probably be a safe house right here in Market Square where everyone would come and just basically, like a storm shelter, like, okay, we're going to ride out the zombie apocalypse.
Ever since the idea came about, Simmons and his team have hunted for just the right furnishings. He says the zombie den will feel like an underground, military-style conclave with items to save you from the impending Armageddon.
When you start thinking about it conceptually, you think, okay, well, if there was a zombie shelter, there would probably be a lot of warning signs and safety signs telling you what to do in the case of an apocalypse.
To ride out the carnage, organizers have conceptualized the list of themed drinks and cocktails. You can grab anything from an amaretto-infused pumpkin spice latte to a shot served in a faux syringe. The Zombie Den will be open until early November. I'm Sabrina Boudin, 90.5 WESA News.
And finally, with the elections just 5 weeks away, campaigns are heating up. More commercials, mailers, and yard signs. But maybe not in the borough of Beaver. The borough has an ordinance that prohibits political signs on private property more than 30 days before the election. Well, the ACLU sent a letter to the borough warning the borough that its ordinance puts unconstitutional time limits on political signs and violates the First Amendment by targeting political free speech. For today, that's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On tomorrow's show, 25 years ago, Tom Murphy was elected to his first term as mayor of Pittsburgh. We'll talk with him about what the city faced then and now.
Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Mick Stinelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.